It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car looked in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Rex Ehrman was sentenced to three consecutive life terms plus 100 years in Suffolk, in a Suffolk County courtroom. Those extra 100 years, just, you know, for good measure, just in case. The judge called him disgusting, told the officers to remove him, and the families of eight dead women stood up and cheered. But inside the plea deal that put him there is a confession to a murder he was never charged with. An appeal, right, his lawyers fought 3 years to protect and then gave away. And an agreement with the FBI, in an agreement with others, and the FBI agreements that the DA swears isn't an investigation. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, with us to help break down what actually happened in that courtroom and what it cost. Heuermann, he looked at the judge and said, I killed Karen Vergata. No charges were filed in that one. That's what a lot of people are wondering about here. Her family was right there in the courtroom. He never had the charge, but part of it was admitting to the murder. Eric, why? Why is it kind of a half-assed admission that he can't be prosecuted on? I think we're all kind of confused about that.
You know, it's pretty unusual, Tony. And think about if you were that victim's family and you know, this person is being convicted and there'll be a final conviction of all these other murders. And then for your family member, it's just sort of some lip service saying, oh, yeah, I did that one, too, but not going to sustain a conviction, not going to have a sentence for that one. If I was the family, I would be super peeved. I haven't seen this kind of something built into a plea like this where you admit to a crime for which you're not charged and for which you're not going to be convicted or sentenced. I don't know if it was just some kind of attempt at closure, but I think it was probably a failed attempt.
Do you think it might have been I'm sorry, go ahead, Tony.
I would just say, yeah, it just seems very empty for that family. Go ahead, Robin.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, empty for the family, which is the greatest injustice. But do you think, like, how did that come about? It struck me as really Rex doing an oopsie and his defense not catching. Is that possible? That, I mean, how is the defense, his attorneys miss that if they miss it all? Like, why even have that out there?
Yeah, I don't see how it confers any substantial benefits to either side. You know, the prosecution does not secure a conviction. They don't get a sentence. On the defense side, you're sort of making this admission of some horrible wrongdoing. For what benefit are you getting in exchange for that? It just seems like a bizarre way to try and sort of loop in this other alleged incident into a criminal case that's already going on, but doing so in kind of a half-assed way.
Yeah, because, I mean, when you think about it, because, again, I am still 100% in the camp that he's got zero empathy. He's not trying to reconcile with anyone. He's not trying to be remorseful. He's incapable of all those things. And so he's not doing it to kind of, like, satisfy the family's need to know. And the only thing that he still holds as his currency is the knowledge of what he did, and he'd hold on to every little scrap he had. I mean, he literally gave up one more thing he could use to get leverage later on if he wanted attention. So that also then begs me to say, I think there's more.
I think there's more to the story as to why he added that, or why that was added in there. And I don't know if it was just a slip of the tongue to Asa and then it was added. Because, I mean, is it a timing thing, I wonder? That's what I kind of keep going back to. Like, okay, well, it looks like he might have done this. He's confessing to it, but we don't have the goods to truly, if we were to take this and prosecute him, to go all the way and get him convicted. But he's saying it, so is it just, let's just, you know, not waste time here attempting this. I also have a wonder, pure conjecture of, I wonder if they're looking at the timeline of Rex Heuermann's existence on this planet, if there's something else going on behind the scenes, and the thought process was, he's admitting to it now, the time it's going to take to get a conviction on this extra charge is going to push this back by years or months, I don't know, but think it might go a little bit of a ways, and let's get him admitting to this on the record while he's still on Earth. I don't know. I mean, he's not super old, but who knows? He doesn't look like the healthiest, you know, ogre on the planet. I wonder if there's something there. If there's a limited time left for Rex here, and it was just let's get. Have you ever seen anything like that, Eric? Where someone knows. Maybe there's, again, pure conjecture, but if someone knows there's an illness or whatever and he doesn't have a lot of time left, where any of this is sped up so a conviction and a sentencing can take place while the person is alive.
You know, I'm wondering, Tony, if that timeline played a role. You know, the prosecutor can only bring charges if they believe they have probable cause. Now, that's mm-hmm. a low standard, but it's still a standard. And a confession alone, is that probable cause without anything else, without other evidence? That's arguable. And so perhaps the prosecutor's been like, hey, this is a way to sort of loop in this other incident to try and bring some semblance of closure. He's going to admit to it anyway. And if we had to go, you know, by the book, it's going to extend this thing number of years. And so let's lock this in now. He's ready to lock in the other ones. Let's mm-hmm. include this one. You know, it's imperfect the way we're doing it, but it's something as compared to the alternative approach, which could take additional years. And maybe the prosecution just doesn't have the goods on that specific incident.
Yeah, I'm kind of in that camp too. Is like, again, how does he benefit from this in any way possible? And I just think it helps him in his prison setting. He can get into his normalized routine, and might even give him leverage on the inside potentially. That's the only thing I can see, because it's got to be self-serving. It did not serve anyone but him. There's no doubt.
When we look at the actual deal that was cut here, I don't see a lot of benefits other than he's not going to die, but that really wasn't on the table to begin with. He got three consecutive life sentences, 100 years stacked on top of that. He's obviously never getting out. But they fought for so long. They fought for so long to throw out the DNA and the warrants and all different things. And it went on and on and on and on. Why now? I guess why do you, in your opinion, why after looking at all this, why do you think they decided, okay, let's just go for a plea here? Is that the attorneys going, dude, you know, we can take it, but you don't got a leg to stand on?
Yeah, you know, if every client acted in their best legal interest, and if they all followed my advice, my job would be a lot easier. But that's not how it plays out. Sometimes they do erratic shit that this doesn't make sense. That you look at a cost-benefit analysis, and you're like, why are you doing this? Now, usually it's the other way. Usually they're facing insane evidence, and they choose to go to trial anyway and expose themselves to a greater risk. Here it's the opposite, in the sense that he's making a decision that is really impairs his legal interests. He has multiple consecutive life sentences. You know, his attorney said at sentencing, he addressed the victims' families and said the reason was because he didn't want to put them through it. I don't believe that for a second. Perhaps it's to not put his family through it and have even dirtier stuff be publicly exposed, but still kind of a head scratcher even after sentencing.
Yeah, I still think it was hold on to as much information as you can that the trial was going to expose on him, as well as anything in the Carolinas that would have been, I think, even worse for him. I think it was total control of his narrative, total control of his fantasy life, no regard for anyone else. And still, I mean, when you we were talking about this yesterday with Siobhan, our psychotherapist, you know, I think he maintains even an easier control over Asa, because there's not more that's been exposed. So he's been able to control exactly what Asa has known, rather than it coming out in court where he loses that control. And so he still has, as we were saying yesterday, Asa actually has him exactly where she wanted him in her entire life, under the roof where he can't get out and go see another prostitute again.
And it makes you wonder a little bit about all of it, because of the Rex that we saw in court yesterday when he
said, my words have no meaning, and just very briefly made his statement, basically saying all these things that you're talking about, I did them. My words have no meaning, so I'm going to leave it at that. It sounded like the wrecks that we heard on the phone calls between those two together. There's if we're trying to look at Rex and the way he's behaving publicly now, I mean, there's a lot of monstrous people that have been charged with horrible crimes like this, and they don't come across in court as anything but monstrous. He just kind of, if you didn't know he did these things, you'd have no idea. I mean, he's just, other than having a bad toupee and kind of looking like Shrek. I mean, he's just kind of, just kind of the guy. I wonder if he comes across as a monster, that would probably push Asa away. And he needs Asa right now, at least I think for his own mental well-being. It's the only person that's still standing by him. So I wonder if the lever of not being monstrous in court or being more direct about any of these crimes is an effort to keep her close to the vest so he can manipulate and use her more from behind bars rather than scaring her and pushing her away and being more vocal about the horrific deeds that he did.
Very well could be. And, you know, I thought his demeanor was rather curious during that hearing. Pretty aloof. It kind of seemed like a guy who was there on a traffic ticket. And he's like, hey, you know, I did this, and I can't really change it. And so, yeah, but, you know, whatever. And that just seems weird when we're talking about, like, you know, a multiplicity of grisly murders. And so I was sort of struck by just the way he presented. And what is his game? Is it to control Asa? Is it to protect Asa? Perhaps during the trial, he knows information could have come out that could further implicate her. And perhaps that could be a reason to not proceed with the trial, even if the government doesn't have it in their possession. He might say, hey, through this, through these witnesses and through these exhibits, they're going to get to the real truth of this. And I'm just speculating there, but I think there are a number of potential reasons.
Well, remember, his main motivation as a serial killer has been sadistic control. And so Tony made a great point, is his way to maintain that sadistic control was by doing this over Asa. So he doesn't have the physical proximity anymore, but he still has amazing control over her. She is living in his room that he did all this in. He knows it. You don't think he's getting some sort of satisfaction out of that? Guaranteed. And then, one more point on this, I have been routinely calling every single person we've ever covered an idiot, a moron, because they are, not Rex. Rex is probably, hands down, the most intelligent, strategic killer and homicidal moron, idiot that we've seen. Not idiot in the sense of intelligence. He's highly intelligent, but that's where I think the difference in this is his moves are very, very strategic for his own benefit, more than I think we've ever covered.
I wonder how much he's handling her with kid gloves still, too, because I wonder what she might know about the Carolinas. And we'll get that in a moment. I am not accusing her of any crime. I don't know. I mean, I'm not accusing her and saying that she was necessarily conscious that he was doing horrible crimes. But I'm saying I wonder if retrospectively she's looking at life and going, oh, that's what that was all about. Different moments in life that just didn't quite add up, because you'd imagine over, 30-some years, there would have been a little mask slipping every now and then. She was on a mission not to see it, no matter what. But I do wonder if there is some knowledge that she may hold that could bring charges in the Carolinas, which could also bring a death penalty.
Not her.
Not on her. Yeah.
I think Victoria would, because remember, she's blocking it out. I think the daughter, the one who's having the aha light bulbs going off every other day, that poor traumatized girl is the one who's probably piecing it all together. I think Asa, as we've covered, I think she's got her life so bifurcated with him. You know, I think I don't know if she'll ever think of him in anything except the knight in shining armor. I mean, she's just so locked into that. So she will block that out. But now Victoria, that's the one I think if he was going to be afraid of anyone, I'd be afraid of her.
Of what she could say or do. I do wonder, but I do wonder you know, she was really young through a lot of this. And I wonder how much of her memory is just not going to be super strong for what dad was up to this way and that way. But who knows? I mean, there may be.
But she's the one that can have daily conversations with Asa.
True.
So yeah. She's the one that actually can get the leakage over time where Asa mm-hmm. isn't going to have defenses down because they're not being telecised. And I'm sorry, we're excluding you from asking you these questions, Eric, but it is a curious thing about how he's trying to manipulate everything around himself to protect himself, I think, from further things that could actually cost him his life.
His ex-wife, Asa, her attorney picked up his dry cleaning so he could wear his suit. So I think if anyone's wondering about because there's time since they filmed the last chapter of the documentary on Peacock. Maybe the relationship has changed since then. The fact that her attorney is picking up his dry cleaning for sentencing, what does that tell you about what that relationship is like today, Eric?
It tells me that they are still potentially in league with each other, at least in terms of this ongoing saga and what side everybody is on. You know, I know there's been a divorce, but we've also seen a history of support, even as the allegations emerged. And so, seems like they're kind of on the same team still, even if they don't want to be terribly public about that.
Yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue our conversation about the sentencing of Rex Huerman. Links are in the description. Asa Alrup skipped the sentencing. Her attorney said the day should belong to the families, and it should. But Asa's legal problems may have just started. Valerie Mack's son has filed a wrongful death lawsuit naming Asa, her daughter Victoria, and Rex, alleging they knew or deliberately avoided knowing what was happening inside that house. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor with us, to tell us if there's any teeth to a suit like this. The lawsuit doesn't just say Asa missed the signs. It says she actively concealed what was happening. Civil conspiracy. That's calling the wife of a serial killer his co-conspirator. What does have to be proven to make something like that stick?
Sure, Tony. And I've read the complaint and, respectfully, I think there are some problems with it legally.
Yeah.
But to make that stick, you know, what they would have to prove is that Asa had an agreement with Rex. Now, it doesn't have to be an express agreement. It could be kind of implicit or whatever, but there was an agreement for her to provide material aid. She knew of the crimes he was committing, and she wanted to further them in somehow, including trying to conceal them. And that's a tall order. And when you look at the complaint, it has a lot of sort of somewhat bald allegations regarding that, but not a ton of details on it. And so, they're going to have to prove a lot to get there to say Asa was essentially complicit in all of this. You know, just saying it is one thing, but proving it's another.
Yeah, I'm curious because we've been talking about Asa so much in the last couple of weeks and in the last couple of days even more. And she seems to have these completely like very, very thick rose-colored glasses when looking at Rex. I can almost imagine him doing these things in front of her and her being blind to it because her blinders are so narrowly focused when regarding him. So what's a prosecutor going to be able to, even if they had a photo of her, I mean, watching this, is that enough? In other words, what do they need to be able to prosecute this? If her context, I mean, I guarantee you she could pass a polygraph most likely because she doesn't internally believe it, that these things ever happened or that he ever did them or she was ever present for him, whatever the charge is going to be on it. And so outside of that, how does her context of what happened really play into the prosecution?
Well, you know, they'd have to prove her knowledge, her agreement with Rex, and her providing some kind of material aid. So that can come in the form of witness statements. I mean, if Rex were to turn on her and say, hey, yeah, I told Asa about this, and then we had an agreement she'd help me cover it up, and then she took these acts X, Y, and Z. She provided me these supplies. Here are the receipts. Here are the text messages. Here are the emails, something like that. That would be the type of evidence we'd be looking for.
Oh, so that's an interesting. So let's go down that one a little bit. I'm sorry, my conjecture road.
Okay.
So I don't imagine a world where he probably openly discussed these things with her, sent her text because he's a smart guy about this, and it would probably fly right over her head because she's got it blocked out. But this material aid is an interesting one. What if they were able to show through purchases and stuff that she actually was tasked by Rex to go out and purchase things for decapitating, for all the horrendous sadistic things he was doing, that she actually made purchases or was aware of those purchases? Is that enough?
She would have to be knowingly aiding him in the commission of a crime.
There's
simply saying, hey, can you go purchase this saw or something? That wouldn't be enough.
Yeah. And that's where it gets into tricky territory. I was wondering the same thing, because providing aid and concealment of crimes, people can do both of those things and not be aware that they're providing aid or concealing a crime at the same point if that context is lifted. So the awareness piece is the lever that the prosecution and that would need to pull and need to make the jury feel that, yes, she was certainly aware. But I guess, is there a line ever that courts draw, even when the person says, I had no idea that I was doing this? I mean, a simple example would be like, hey, honey, my clothes are real dirty, and she washes his clothes. I'm not saying this happened. I'm just, for a pure conjecture example, she washes the clothes, and they had blood on them, and she doesn't ask any questions. She just does it. Let's say she saw blood, but doesn't ask any questions. Is that awareness, or is that, I could see Asa just being like, oh, you know, it's red paint, or she telling herself some bullshit so right. She doesn't have to mentally go to where the evidence that's sitting right in front of her, screaming at her, actually is. Where does the court say, you're an effing idiot if you don't think that this was,
you know,
like if he was doing like the Brian Walsh Home Depot run with barrels.
That's why I used that example too. Yeah.
I mean, if she was on camera buying all this shit and then it's like, there's no, what did you think he was doing with these things? You never saw them. He wasn't like making a compost pile in the backyard with leaves and you never saw him do it. What do you think? I mean, where is the line here where the court says, I'm sorry, your stupidity argument or ignorance argument just doesn't fly?
Sure. Sir, it's a great question, because on so many accomplice cases, you know, the accomplice who's caught says, oh, I didn't know they were doing crimes over there. And then they're like, oh, well, you know, you see this, you see drugs lying around and you see them getting money and their scales. And then they ask you to buy a bunch of baggies. Well, you probably did know. The line here, Tony, is it's defined differently in different states. But in Colorado, where I practice, knowingly is being practically certain that such circumstances exist. So that's a pretty high bar. And just seeing some blood, just seeing some suspicious circumstances, that probably doesn't get you there. But if there were further conversations, if there were acknowledgments from Asa in some form, text, email, statements to her daughter, something, that might get you over that threshold. But it's really, is the person practically certain that such circumstances exist, meaning that a crime was going on? Simply saying some blood, man, it's probably not enough. The guy could have been in a butcher shop. He could have been, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a pure example. I just wonder, it's just like where, and it's up for interpretation, I'm sure. It's up to that judge to say, this is the line. I like your example. It was great with the scales and all that. They're not baking cookies. That's not cornstarch over there. That's, you know.
But at this point, given what we've seen of this, you know, she'd probably believe it. I mean, she believes he's a knight in shining armor, you know, and she, I mean, even after all she's bared witness to throughout their lives, and we saw it, you know, like it or hate it, you know, Peacock did a really great job, you know, kind of giving us an arc of her for at least a period of time from her own statements. She seems just as much infatuated with him. I don't want to, her definition of love, we went through this yesterday, is a little bit different, but she's as infatuated with him today as she was when she first met him, it seems like. And so I think her ability to recognize what's right in front of her is low. That's why I think it's a challenging civil lawsuit, because I don't think you're going to get anything. And even if you did, it's easy to defend. She's clueless.
And the DA's office has cleared Asa. So the civil case, and there's plenty of times where, you know, the DA clears somebody and there's still a civil case. That's what happens a lot. But it does make me wonder about just, you know, how strong that case can possibly be and where it might go, considering that they didn't have anything. But it does make me wonder, too. There's limited resources in that DA's office. They got a lot of cases to prosecute. I mean, we're talking about Long Island. We're talking about New York. We're talking about it's a country unto itself, the amount of people in the area. So there's a lot of priorities. It does make me wonder. And Eric, tell me this. Have you ever seen cases where you have, you know, the big one, they got him, and they're looking down the road at Asa going, yeah, I mean, if we really dig, if we spend hundreds and thousands of hours digging into her, maybe we'll find some snippet that looks like she may have had some sort of awareness here. But the best we're going to get out of it is you know, a very small sentence or just a penalty of some sort that is minuscule. And it's not worth spending all of that time just to get there with her. And they're rolling the dice going, I'm going to guess there's not more than possibly that. Do they ever just, they got their big fish and the other one, it's not worth it. Go ahead. You're going to go, you know, flop around out here anyhow. You're probably not a danger to anyone. He was the real danger. And they just don't go further. Could that be what's going on in this too?
Look, these offices have limited resources. They have an oppressive caseload, especially in a large metropolitan district like that. And so they've got to make judgment calls. They've got to say, hey, what does justice look like here? Is justice, you know, we already got the big fish, like you said. Does justice require us to spend another, you know, millions of dollars potentially and years going after this small fry for whom there might be shaky evidence? We don't have enough now. Should we really proceed with that? Is that in the community's best interest, then in the best interest of justice and in terms of the victims' families and things like that? You know, what more do the victims' families get if Asa is convicted?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it'd be a really meaningful benefit to them. I don't know, but I'm not sure.
I mean, does Asa have anything to worry about with civil discovery here? If, you know, I'm wondering if somewhat of the DA is almost indirectly outsourcing the investigation into Asa into the civil world. And should, I mean, who knows what could come up in civil discovery? This has happened before where a civil case unearths some evidence that the original investigation did not find. And it turns out, oh, look what we found here. That's criminal. All conjecture, not saying she did anything illegal. But if the civil case in discovery somewhere does find criminal behavior, could that lead then to criminal charges against her as they were discovered indirectly through the civil case?
It's possible. And you know, you on the criminal side, so they're looking into Rex, right? And of course, they're investigating Asa and everybody else. But, you know, did they do a complete download of all of Asa's devices for more than 10-year span? I'm not sure they did that. I'm not sure they reviewed it. On the civil side, though, that they could request all of those digital forensics and say, hey, we need any emails, text messages, voicemails, internet searches for the past 20 years. And depends on what the judge would do. There'd probably be some limitations, but that might uncover information that the prosecutors either didn't seek or didn't look at or something like that. So it's possible that more could come out and that it could be to the legal detriment of us.
And help me also understand the civil lawsuit side against Victoria, the daughter who was, you know, at best a mid-teenager when these crimes took place. How does that make her civilly liable? I mean, can you go after an underage kid for being civilly liable for the murder of anyone?
You can. An underage person can have civil liability, but under these circumstances, what are they saying that this daughter knew? What are they saying that she assisted with? I've read the complaint. It's pretty just sort of these vague accusations all of these defendants were proximal to what happened and they allowed access to the premises and things like this. But there's nothing terribly specific in there. And I just don't see how the daughter could be looped in civilly, criminally, or otherwise.
And what are you going to get? They got nothing except the house they just remodeled that everyone wants to tear down. I mean, just, well, I get the pain they're trying to get restitution for, but it's rough.
Well, and I wonder with Victoria too. I mean, is the civil lawsuit kind of like, let's throw a bunch of spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks? Like maybe Victoria will be, you know, taken off the lawsuit at some point if they're only going to find Asa to be viable to go at. I don't know. I mean, sometimes you see that where a lot of people are being sued at once. And then as it processes through court, it's like, yeah, not her. She's really not part of this. But the other one does. I mean, it also feels like a pretty weak suit if you're just kind of throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks and don't have any real, clear, solid information. And you're just hoping that maybe you're going to find some stuff in discovery.
One thing I'm wondering along those lines, Tony, is, you know, Victoria's still pretty young in age. She's dealt with this massive nationally publicized trauma regarding her family for quite some time now. And now she's struck with a civil lawsuit, you know, requesting probably millions of dollars in damages. That might freak out a young person. And are they sort of betting on the possibility that Victoria is going to get scared and she's going to do something abrupt and unpredictable that young people might do, like try to protect herself and say, oh gosh, well, you know, if I give you information or if I make up information or something, am I going to get out of this? Can I please move on with my life? How do I do that? Is it talking with you guys in an interview and telling you what you want to hear? Oh, if so, you know, me in my 20s, I need to be done with this. I could see a young person being scared into doing that. And perhaps that's sort of an intimidation tactic here on behalf of plaintiff's counsel. I can't say for sure, but those things happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of roads that could be gone down here. And again, we're not saying Victoria had anything to do case. I feel horrible for that young woman. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, this is the world she was brought into and she's, you know, trying to navigate this utter shit show. So, yeah, I mean, but it does make sense. I mean, I'm wondering if she is being used as a lever to get information, not so much as a way to let's go punish you, but let's scare the living shit out of you even more. And see what else you can tell us that maybe she's even unaware that she's may tell. Depositions could be very interesting in a case like this. You know, if we get there what's in the actual suit itself, is there a risk here that we don't even get that far, that they don't even get to depositions, that a judge at some point just says, yeah, no, we're not going to go down this road unless you got something that is showing us some solid shit. We're not going to do it. Or in a civil case, is it much easier to get into those deposition stages before the judge says yay or nay?
You know, I would anticipate seeing a motion from defense to throw out some or all of these claims rather soon. In reviewing them, you know, I look, and we'll talk about this soon, but if like the unjust enrichment claim, I think there are legal problems with that. The civil conspiracy claim, there are legal problems just on the face of the complaint and that just don't meet that might not meet the threshold for the case to move forward. And I could see a judge looking at it. And then, you know, you add in sort of the dynamics of what's going on in the case and all the national exposure, a judge might say, hey, this is going to stop here because of legal insufficiency. That would not be shocking to me, especially after reading that complaint.
Yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on our conversation thus far on the Gilgo Beach killer Rex Huerman and Asa and Victoria and the whole family and everybody that is experiencing the hell that is this. Links are in the description. The judge said it out loud at the sentencing of Rex Huerman. 8 that we know of. Huerman owned property also in South Carolina, had timeshares in Las Vegas. Can you imagine being the timeshare salesperson, like, hey, you want that free dinner over at the IHOP? You just got to come over here. And I wonder how many certificates Rex, can I get an extra one? I really like the pancakes. But he had timeshares. He had timeshares in Las Vegas, and investigators have looked at ties to Atlantic City as well. Some of those states execute people for what Heuermann did. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, is with us to break down whether the number eight is where this ends or where it all starts. That plea deal, of course, protects him in Suffolk County for these eight women. They're not going to be prosecuted again. It's done. But if South Carolina finds a body connected to him, does that New York deal mean anything in their courtroom? Should information come about?
The only thing it would mean, in my impression, is that it'd be much more likely that Rex Heuermann would be put to death if the Carolina case was provable, because it certainly doesn't protect him in any form or fashion. If anything, it's just aggravating to the extent that he has been convicted of eight other murders. Oh, now we're on nine? Like, I think at some point a jury and a judge might say, hey, this can't go on forever. You've got your chances. And I think it makes the death penalty way more likely.
Resources are a big thing. How much incentive does Carolina's or any of these other areas where he may have been hunting, how much incentive do they have to put resources at trying to connect Rex Heuermann to unsolved murders from decades ago when he's already locked up for eternity? Is it something that would be high in the priority list of somebody there? I guess, you know, for the right reasons. You can look at maybe if somebody's running for election and they want to crack a big case, this would make some headlines. But is it worth it, I guess, in terms of if there's not that other lever and some other motive to go after this case for South Carolina or another area to spend the resources trying to connect those dots?
You know, I think that those authorities and those other locales would be remiss if they had significant leads and did not at least explore them. Although they would be cold cases, so those are extremely hard to investigate. All, you know, your evidence has eroded, witnesses have died. It costs a ton of money to pursue that. But on the flip side, you have these convictions of Rex, and you have sort of a modus operandi, a pattern that he has used to time and again to commit these similar atrocities. And if you can line up that pattern with evidence you find in your locale, that makes it significantly easier to pursue a conviction. So upsides and downsides. Resources are certainly front of mind, but so are the optics of all this. And I don't think any authorities in those jurisdictions want to say, this person died, but that was a long time ago. It's going to cost a lot of money. We're not going to look into it.
So I'm curious about this one, Eric, because we haven't quite seen it in any of the cases we've covered before. So say you have a family or a couple families in South Carolina or in Vegas or somewhere that, you know, have a private investigator. They're able to do their own investigation. They're able to say that they believe that Rex was responsible for the death of their family member, but South Carolina is not picking up as a criminal thing. Can they then go after Rex civilly without a criminal case?
But you're running into, under those circumstances, statute of limitations issues. Statute of limitations for civil claims are way shorter than on the criminal side. They're usually like 3 years or something. And there are tolling exceptions. But if you believe this guy did it, you would have to show like some newly discovered evidence that would renew the statute. It would be a tall order to pursue that.
Right. I guess my question on that would be, what attorney would take up that case if there's not much to get out of it civilly, other than it's the, you know, getting justice, the right thing to do, that sort of a thing. I mean, I get it, but again, I mean, nobody works for free. Everybody needs to eat. And that would be a lot of work.
Marketing, you know, we covered.
I mean,
if you're trying to get your name out there as a civil guy, as a defense attorney, you're basically doing a pro bono.
But you would get on everything. You would really get a lot of attention that way. That is true. That's a lever to pull.
Yeah, you would. You know, in the wrongful death context, most attorneys take those on what's called a contingency fee, meaning they only get paid a percentage of whatever the recovery is. This guy doesn't have any assets. They're not going to be able to. There would be no financial incentive for an attorney to do it. It would have to be some other motivation.
The DA called the FBI interviews that he's supposed to be doing with the BAU eventually here from prison, the Behavioral Analysis Unit, academic, not investigative. So think if anybody's watching this going, what is this all about? Mindhunter. There you go. That's what they're talking about doing, just like the show. If Huerman describes something in that room that matches an unsolved case in another state, can it be used if this is academic, not investigative? Is that just the words being thrown into the ether right now, but they really hold no weight? Should Huerman reveal something that nobody's expecting?
Yeah, so the FBI isn't writing a treatise or some legal scholarship that they're going to publish in some collegiate journal or something.
Yeah.
They could give whatever purported purpose that they want, but absolutely, if the FBI acquires information that is useful in an investigation, there is nothing prohibiting them from using that, even if they said, it's not an investigation, guys, it's academic. Well, you stumbled upon evidence of a crime. At that juncture, they would be perhaps duty-bound to continue to pursue that investigation despite whatever kind of pretext they wanted to label the interview as.
Yeah, because one of the things they're going to be going for in these interviews with him is his life arc of methodology, how it evolved, how he stayed ahead of investigators, how he controlled his environment. And we know a decent amount about how he controlled Long Island, but he had different venues in which he lived. And so they're definitely going to be very interested in this, because remember, he's got a sadistic fantasy world going on in his head, and he's acting out on it in Long Island, but he also traveled these other locations. They're going to be very interested in, did his modus operandi of sadistic satisfaction transfer and morph into something different in these other locations? And so they're not going to say, hey, what'd you do in South Carolina? They're going to say, how did you play out this sadistic fantasy of yours throughout your life? How did that look? How did it evolve? And so then they're going to be able to then look back in all the places he's lived and resided and vacationed and seeing if there's any fit there. And then they can even probe in there. And because that's what they're really trying to do, then you take that academic side and overlay it with operational things. And then you reapply that new filter, which is a profile, to these cold cases and see if anything fits.
Yeah, I agree.
How do they get the information about his whereabouts over 30 years? I mean, it's one thing, you know, in the last 10, 15, it's a pretty good digital trail on almost everybody. But you go before then, it's harder to find records and things like that. How much information do they already have about all of those years of his life, of where he was, when he was? I mean, we know that he had a timeshare out there. He had some property. There was different places he had these sort of things. In the investigation into where we got today in New York, how much do they know about when he was in the Carolinas or when he was in other locations? I would imagine like forensic accounting might answer some of those questions to see where receipts are if you look at bank statements. But like, other than that, how do you truly dig into that type of data when it goes so far back to say you were here on this date? How does that process even work to start getting some answers?
Those investigators are going to have to get creative. It is extremely difficult to investigate someone's whereabouts decades ago. Heck, if someone asked me where I was, you know, two Wednesdays ago at 6:45 p.m., I'd probably...
My credit card would tell you. That would be about it.
Yeah. So I'll tell you.
You know, so you got to look at that, see if there's a paper trail. Sometimes when it comes to property, that there are, you know, ownership records, there are leases, there are things that are recorded with the clerk and recorder. There are witnesses who, you know, perhaps next to the timeshare, there's a house that's been there for 50 years and it's been in the same family. You go to that family and you talk to them. You know, are there any sort of Polaroids that might have been found at Rex Hurlman's location? You kind of have to get creative in those respects, but very difficult.
I think that the greatest tool I had when I was able to go up on someone's information when tracking bad guys, when I had credit card statements, it was gold. That was my gold, because that established timelines, it established places they frequented, established likes, interests, and the travel we're talking about. And what's the benefit to all the investigators on this is what he looks like. and they've said it before, he's extremely recognizable. So you get a credit card statement, because you can get credit card statements for a long time. I mean, there's you can track this stuff for a very long time. You take a photograph, you go interview people at these locations, and you start jogging memories through these interviews. I think because of how he looks and how he behaved, you're going to have an easier time establishing timelines and locations than you will with more average looking guy.
That's a good point.
I like to know more about these properties that he's owns or the timeshares, because I could be wrong, and correct me if I am, but in all the things that we've viewed on this case and heard about this case, we've heard about these things existing, but we've never heard about anybody really frequenting them other than Rex, if you got the timeshare. We didn't hear anything about, oh, and then the family went to the timeshare. I mean, maybe it's in there. I could be completely off, and it just hasn't stood up. But I do find it interesting that, oh, you know, her husband, dad's got this property, but nobody's ever going to it or checking it out other than him. Weird dynamics, but the family is the definition of a weird dynamic. So it probably could have been completely normal. But that seems to be a little odd to me that there wasn't like, oh, we love going to that timeshare every year or whatever.
Of course. And, you know, in most family dynamics, if the family has some kind of vacation home or some sort or something like that, or even like, let's say they had like a jet ski and it was at some dock or some lake, you know, it'd be weird if only one member of that family ever went and utilized that. And everyone else, you know, wouldn't the kids say, hey, we want to go check out the jet ski? Wouldn't the wife say, hey, yes, you know, does it need to be maintained? What's going on with that? That's of shared financial interest. You would just think that those things would come up and it wouldn't be just one person go to this timeshare.
After he bought a bag, a chain and an anchor from Home Depot and went out on the jet ski by himself.
The Scott Peterson special at the Depot.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. And I know people have been putting in the comments as well. Yeah, with his DNA being in CODIS, there's also that chance also when you start overlapping potential DNA with cold cases, going back in time on those with credit card statements, with interviews, with photos. I think when it comes to possibility of hope of identifying more victims of his being associated with him, there's a higher probability with him than others because of that.
I wonder if there is, how long it will take for those names to be identified, to be associated with him. I mean, just thinking back on other cases, you know, sometimes it's, you know, many years after they're already dead. I mean, 30, 40. But the thing is, a lot of that DNA from these cold cases, it's not just like sitting in a digital file where they can just do a quick search and like, let's match this to right. Those cases are literally archived physically somewhere. So someone has to take the information, take the DNA, get it into the system, and then that sort of matching can be done, and only then. So either that happens because they're going through the inventory and they're putting everything into the system as one big fail swoop, or it's, hey, let's go grab this one. This seemed to happen around the time that we know he was here. Let's see if there's any matches.
Well, the challenge in this is, you know, the further south you go, you're dealing with decomposition of people faster and a little, you know, I think the areas to dispose of bodies are more more vast, I guess, in South Carolina than in Long Island, New York. And then you have the desert environment in Vegas. So I think getting DNA from victims and having victims identified in those areas might be more challenging than they were necessarily in Long Island. But because, again, I think that's just one potential hurdle to faster rather than later.
Eric, how do you think he's going to do in prison? He's a very different personality than others. Is this one that goes into Gen Pop right away with his jovial attitude? Or is he really in danger just because of the notoriety of who he is? And he would be a target for someone to take down the Gilgo Beach killer.
You know, on that point, Tony, I read a report indicating that another serial killer who's incarcerated, I don't have his
happy
name
face.
My tongue.
Yeah. Happy face killer.
And I'm pretty sure that this killer sent some kind of message or letter to Rex basically saying, like, hey, prison's going to be a problem for you. Like, I know you're a big dude, but it's a numbers game in prison, and you got to have allies. You got to have a crew. And I'm not sure that this kind of freak is going to be able to garner that kind of protection. In fact, I think the attention he's going to get is going to be the opposite of protection.
You think he'll join a gang, Rex Sherman?
No one would want him.
Wonder what gang he would join.
Be a motley crew of weirdos.
The Toops of Long Island. It's just everybody has a toupee. Does he get to keep his toupee in prison, or are they toupee-less in prison?
I can't say I've ever seen a person that I've known to wear a toupee to have that in jail or prison. You know, in jail, you gotta take out your piercings, know, permanent modifications that you've done to your body. Sometimes those are undone. And so I doubt he's going to be able to keep that, man.
We're going to see a very different looking Rex Heuermann in the coming weeks.
I don't think he's going to be around long. I think he's going to die pretty rapidly in prison is my guess.
A self-exit? Or deletion, or is somebody going to hit control alt delete on him?
I think it's health. I really do. I mean, he is a big guy, and he's got a lot of rough years on him. It looks like. I just don't think his health is the best.
At the end of the day, carbs are going to kill him.
Yeah,
literally. Yeah. It's like too much carbs, not enough protein. That took out the Gilgo Beach killer.
Yeah, he's still in Suffolk County because someone asked him where he's being housed right now. Yeah. He's still in Suffolk County custody right now.
Yeah, there you go. Rex Heuermann sentenced. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love to continue the conversation right there. All right. Until next time, Eric Faddis, thank you for being here. Robin Drake, and for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.